All right. If everyone can take a seat and get ready here, that would be fantastic. All right. So thank you again to our break sponsor, so T.H. Glenn and Company. Thank you for the nice refreshments there. I don't think our next speaker needs significant introduction, but I will, before I jump to that even, still do not have a solid plan of how we will make sure you get the original content that we were going to present here, but we will make sure it's delivered and that is communicated out to the membership. We do want to make sure you're able to hear that. Very grateful and thankful that David Crowe was able to kind of step in and kind of continue what he started, give us some opportunities to ask some questions. He does have some additional content prepared to kind of stir conversation, but as he's going, please feel free to jump in, ask questions. Let's make this engaging. Consider it kind of a continuation of where he left off yesterday. And with that, I will turn it over to David.
God, I feel sorry for you. You stuck with me twice. Third prize is I'd never leave. How's that? Well, thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to start by saying that my friend Ann Aquilo can't be here. She is the head of Scott's Company's government relations, and she was a boss of mine for a very long time. She's been a great friend, and she's had a personal health issue in her family, and we probably all wish Ann was here instead of me for 100 reasons. But I'm going to do the best I can, and I want to answer some questions and tell you that I've spent some of the time since I last saw you, other than drinking heavily and sleeping, trying to figure out what the next steps are in Washington, D.C. So Bob and I were just catching up, and is this microphone right? Not loud enough? So since we last talked, I'm going to put three issues on the table for you that the Democrats are dealing with at once. And then tell you what I think they're going to do. So they have to raise the debt ceiling, or else there's a potential for government shutdown. And as we know, there's been several government shutdowns in the last several years. I won't pick on Tom again and say, Tom, you're old enough to remember when George Washington shut down. It's not true. He didn't get here till John Adams came along. So he's going to get me for that. So we have a potential government shutdown sometime in October, if the government does not get enough money to raise the debt ceiling. The Treasury can only borrow so much money, and it's projected to run out in October. Will it be October 1st or October 15th? I don't know, but it's coming. And Congress is going to have to deal with that. So the second issue, and the one I think nearest and dearest to our hearts, is the $1.1 trillion infrastructure bill that really does great things, has terrific bipartisan support, and it does things like fix potholes, new roads, dams, waterways, airports, and what I consider America is becoming almost third world in some of its infrastructure issues, even in Washington, D.C., and the very roads senators and congressmen have to ride, their George Washington Parkway is a disaster. So this money everybody wants. But to get into politics a little bit, which is sort of unavoidable even if you want to talk about environmental regulation, is that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is probably about 20 to 40 members. The moderates, say they're 40, and then there's kind of everybody else. Now, we're going to start with, I'm Speaker Pelosi, and here's my problem. Any bill that I pass, I can only lose 3 votes. So the Republican-Democratic divide is the closest it's been in many, many decades. You have to have 218 votes in the House to get a win. And Nancy Pelosi has 221 Democrats. So in most situations, when you have a healthy majority, you can have up to 10, 20 members say, hey, I just can't vote for this. And the Speaker will generally say, that's okay, because I can still get the 218 without you. And we're going to give you a pass. And she can't do that now. So the progressives are saying the only way we'll vote for your infrastructure package is if you promise us a vote on the $3.5 trillion package. If you don't promise that, we don't give you enough votes on infrastructure and you get nothing. And then, on top of that, the progressives have to go along with voting on debt ceiling, and these are all going to be separate votes. And if they don't vote for debt ceiling, they can't get to any of the things they want. And the government shuts down, and you go through the typical Washington ridiculous rigmarole of negotiating around the clock and some nice family showing up, and they can't go to the Washington Monument, and national parks are shut down, and no one picks up the trash, and all that. And generally, those things don't help the party that causes it. But both parties always try to say, the other party forced me into it. And it's just kind of up to the American people to say, who do you blame? So what makes this tricky is if you're the Democratic majority, you've got all three of these things at once. So if the climate were cooler, so to speak, you could just vote for the infrastructure package, get it on its way, vote for debt ceiling, and put off the 3.6 trillion vote till later. And that would make sense, and that would be a way of getting through the logjam. But the progressive part of the Democratic Party, the AOCs and Bernie Sanders, believe that this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to get the big things. That this is what we talked about before. They've got a one-time chance to get all of this stuff through, and if they don't get it now, they'll never get it, and you won't get back to it. And this is not unlike Obamacare back in Barack Obama's first term. And I want to give you why I think the analogy fits. So you had the same sort of issue with you can't lose very many votes. Now, the Senate has 60 Democrats, so you could get through without a filibuster threat. And then Teddy Kennedy died. The senator of Massachusetts had a brain tumor and he died. And a Republican was appointed, and all at once you don't have 60 votes anymore. And this is back before we talked about getting rid of the filibuster. You had to have 60 votes to get anything done. So what happened was Speaker Pelosi was trapped with a bill that had passed the House. She couldn't amend it. She couldn't make any changes to it. She couldn't fix anything. And I was telling Bob, they didn't know how to cost it out. A lot of it didn't make any sense. A lot of it had been cut and pasted together. But they couldn't send it back through the Senate to get it fixed, so they were stuck. And there were things like 50 pages of staff members' phone numbers. There were pizza orders. There were pieces of paper that accidentally got stuck at 3 a.m. And when they passed this bill, and we all are young enough to remember this, I think, I hope so, Obamacare really was not a manageable piece of health care legislation. And for the next 2 years, the Democrats struggled to get this thing to work. And if there was either a funny or sad moment, I find it was funny, you had the Secretary of Health and Human Services sitting in Florida at an old people's home saying, everything with Obamacare is fixed. I'm going to sign you up right now, and I want you to watch on national TV. She clicked the button, the screen went black, the computer melted, and they couldn't unfreeze it. The system completely crashed. They didn't have a system in place that could process anything. And this went on for over a year. And so what the Obama administration had to do was they got some people that worked in Microsoft and Apple to come to Washington for free and work around the clock for over 9 months just to get the system to process these new applications. And that's what happens when you overload a system. And this is a lot worse situation in that there's no room to move. If you're the Speaker of the House, you've got an unwieldy group from everywhere, and you've got no room to move. And as I said yesterday in the Senate, even to get to 50, you have to get Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona. So people ask me, why are they so important? Well, if you had 60 votes, they wouldn't be. But when you have 50 votes, if everyone's on board, you can't even lose one. Even if the vice president comes, the vice president only has a vote if it's a tie. The Constitution did a weird thing. The vice president really has no job. Now, in recent presidents, they've kind of given him a job, but it's sort of like, look, I'm going to let you do foreign policy, or I'm going to let you handle Afghanistan, or you're going to be my climate guy. But there's no official job. They just have an office, and they wait around for somebody to die or quit, and that's really about it. But they get to preside over the Senate, which is exactly like herding an entire group of feral cats, and it's equally satisfying. And they listen about as well as those cats do. They're pooping everywhere, running around, falling asleep on you, and they're not listening. So really all the vice president can do is break a tie. So she has to have 50 votes. So here's what I think will happen. And this is, we're just going to spitball this and build it into what I think is going on in Washington, D.C. And I think Ann would be nodding yes, and I hope she would be because she follows this closely and she's very smart. So the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, whether you love her, hate her, or you're neutral, is probably the smartest Speaker of the House and the most effective in many, many decades, all the way back to maybe Tip O'Neill. She is loved and hated, almost like Donald Trump. And interestingly, her numbers were always lower than Donald Trump's. They still aren't very good, because speakers have very, very tough decisions to make. So what this speaker has to do, she's got 13 different committee chairs steering now almost $5 trillion total dollars through the system. And she has to get the debt ceiling, which is a completely separate process. And at the end of the debt ceiling vote, you have to write down the number that this bill will cost. So here's the fuzzy math going on in Washington. And the story is going to change 100 times. This is going to be like a bad novel, right? The good guys win, then the bad guys win, the good guys win, and you hope on the last day the good guys win again. But what she has to do is convince Congress and the people who look at the debt ceiling numbers that this bill really doesn't cost $3.6 trillion for all these social programs, and that the $1.1 trillion will pay for itself. Now, I think the infrastructure bill will pay for itself. I mean, there's fees, there's all kinds of things. It pays for itself. And it's not one of those controversial things that expands all sorts of programs. It just fixes stuff. But when you get to the 3.6, again, you're talking about a child care credit where no one has to look for a job, a very substantial expansion of Obamacare without costing out what it would actually cost. Trying to get 8 million immigrants as American citizens in one day, which they're struggling with. The parliamentarian said we're not going to let that be added. So you've got all these very expensive things. So the Speaker has to go back to her caucus, go to her 221, and find a way to convince the progressives who think that they're not doing near enough and the moderates who think we're doing way too much and convince them to pass these three bills and make them reasonable enough that you can get Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema on the Senate to vote for them. Now, I don't envy her, because the progressives are going to go crazy and say this is terrible. This is a once-in-a-generation or more opportunity. And if we don't get all of this, then we really don't want anything. And that's really how they feel about it. Because in Washington, I think the worst thing that a true believer can get is half a loaf. And it's one of the things wrong with Washington is incremental change and improvement, things that you would do in your business, even in your personal life, are considered unacceptable, because if you don't get it all, the opportunity to put it all in one place and vote on it is very hard to get. That's how come Obamacare got crammed through so fast, is because they didn't think they'd ever get a national health care system that was that expensive through Congress. and they knew they would have some trouble getting it through the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court actually struck part of it down. Right? They decided that you can't mandate a tax, and when you can't mandate a tax, all the healthy young people decided, we don't want to sign up for this. We're going to live forever. Or we're all going to live forever when you're in your 20s and 30s. None of them signed up. So then Obamacare costs a lot more money than they thought it would. Because the best way to run a health care system is have tons and tons of young, healthy people that don't need doctors. That way, you've got a lot of money. When you have a bunch of geezers, Tom will call me a geezer, not you, and they don't have money, and you go into the system. He loved being picked on, by the way. And they go through the system. They're costing a lot of money and not putting much in. Well, you've got some of the same things going on here, right? So look for these things to happen, and then let's take Q&A. Look for a threat of a government shutdown and even a possible shutdown for a few days. Look for Congress to start this around-the-clock thing where, you know, they never leave D.C. because they're scared to death. If somebody sees them, they might throw something at them for not doing their job. And look for all kinds of cut-and-paste deals, 3 a.m. deals on Sunday morning, where you try to convince the progressives they're getting as much as they could get. You're trying to convince the moderates they didn't go too far. You're trying to convince Joe Manchin that this bill makes sense and it doesn't wipe out coal and manufacturing in West Virginia. So you've got to do all these things. And in all honesty, I don't know anybody that I would put my money on more than Nancy Pelosi. Her greatest strength, people say, what's her greatest strength? She can raise $100 million in an afternoon. She's the greatest single fundraiser that either party has ever produced. So if Nancy Pelosi decides that you're in a tough race and she wants to help you, she can give you $5 million just like that. If Nancy Pelosi thinks you've crossed her and you're going to hurt her, she can put up a candidate and $5 million against you just like that. And she's very good at that, and she's very strong. Now, will she scare all of the progressives with that? No. But will she be able to discipline a lot of people who are, you know, worried about their reelect? Yes. You won by 52-53%, and you've made the speaker mad, and you're in her caucus, and she puts a couple of million against you and a candidate, you're going to lose your seat. So that's her power over you, right? The speaker's power is, I can throw you off a committee, I can run a primary candidate against you, I can show up at your district and trash you, and I'm powerful enough that I can really, really hurt you and really, really help you. And she only has survived as a speaker. She survived a long time, right? Most speakers don't survive a long time. It's a tough job, and it's a thankless job. But her ability to raise money, and that is the greatest power any politician has. You know, Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan and Obama were great orators. They were very persuasive. But what's way more persuasive is money. So look at these three bills. The numbers are going to dance around constantly. And I think what happens is a good chunk of the 3.6 either disappears when the Democrats find a way to show it pays for itself. And in my opinion, if any of the big spending expansions don't have a work provision or a repay provision, they can't get through this. Because you can't spend money, expect nothing back, get nothing back, and say you saved money, even in Washington. So I'd like to take questions on this, and I'd like to tell you that these are the kinds of manufactured crisis that Washington does all the time. So it is my opinion that being a member of Congress, being a senator, is a very hard job. When Tom and I started, you didn't even have C-SPAN. If you were a newspaper reporter and you were in Washington, D.C., and you made that member of Congress mad, he never let you get an interview, and you got sent home. You were fired. Politicians had incredible power over the press. In the White House, It was so strong that, and John Hazard told me this story, but I've read it. His grandfather and his father-in-law, they knew reporters and actually worked for him, that knew FDR had a wheelchair. I mean, no one knew that FDR was paralyzed from polio. And if any reporter had ever reported that, they would have been in the Siberian wing of hell. You did exactly what the politicians told you to do. And actually, it was a system that worked, right? You could cut deals, you could do all kinds of crazy stuff. Now, you've got 10 newspaper reporters following you to the bathroom. You've got all this crazy stuff. So this is my way of saying, you have to get in a closed room, and you have to get all the committee chairs, and you get the progressive in one place, and you get the moderates in one place, and you sit them down, and you lock the doors, and you say, folks, you want this, and you're going to get this, and this can't see the light of day, and no one goes to sleep until we come out of this thing with something done. Right? They pick a pope, they let the smoke go out, no one comes in. This is one of those things. So you're going to read 1,000 different things. You're going to read a whole different set of things. They're hearing from Fox and you are MSNBC. The New York Times and Washington Post are going to report it one way. Wall Street Journal will write it another. Luckily, we're all literate and we can sort of go through the fantasy and somehow figure out what's true and what's not. But what we're about to go through is going to be amazing. And it's going to be the only way a very dysfunctional Congress can actually work is to have a gun to their head, no one comes in and out of a room, and they've got to get something through. There's no one to go ask. There's no one to say you did the wrong thing. There's no one to throw rocks at you. There's no one to do anything. You're just stuck, and you have to come to a conclusion. And I think when Congress became unmanageable in my career, it's when every single thing was televised all the time. And so you could actually have a congressional hearing where you did something somebody didn't like and have 5,000 emails waiting for you 15 minutes later. And so this is what Pelosi's trying to push away. So this sets the table, and I would love to hear questions. I want to throw in one other thing that's very important to every person in this room. There's going to be a ton of money for carbon sequestration, whether it's trees or fiber or grass, or anything that grows. Now, Bob and I have talked this through. The Secretary of Agriculture is going to put out some guidelines and regs, and it's going to affect all of us. There's going to be money for us, and what we have to do is figure out how to apply for the programs and fit into these programs. Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack just set aside $67 billion within USDA, and there's going to be more. I don't know how much gets through this legislative rigmarole, but good chunk of money, and all of it's about sequestering carbon. And the people in this room can sequester carbon. And these programs are going to be loaded with some money. So that'll probably happen in October, and it could happen more next year, but we're going to keep you up on that. And we're going to give you opportunities to take a look at this. Robert. So, Bob asked a good question. Step back. So, what are the Republicans going to be doing while the Democrats are caucusing, laughing their head off in the other room? See, the one thing that McConnell and the Republicans have decided to do in the Senate, and this is where McConnell's coming from. You've taken a COVID crisis, and you're trying to turn it into the biggest social increase since FDR. You're manufacturing a gigantic crisis off a public health scare. And you're deciding that the entire world's going to come to an end, that you have to get rid of fossil fuel, natural gas, cars, and you have to tax everyone under the theory that climate change is an instantaneous problem, and if you don't give the money out on these social programs, no one can ever go back to work. And what the Republicans are saying is the COVID created the kind of confidence crisis in an economy and has created a lot of social unrest. The murder rate this year is the highest it's been in 60 years. We know when really crazy social economic times happen, people don't react very well. And this last 18 months have been a great example. So what McConnell's saying is you're taking this crisis and blowing it up to something that it's not. Because of that, you have to raise the debt ceiling without a single vote. You have to get all of this money through both ends of your progressive and your moderate wing. You have to prove what it costs, and we're going to do nothing. This is on you. The infrastructure bill, bipartisan, would get 80 votes just like that. That's not a manufactured crisis. We have a lot of infrastructure issues. But the Republican take is everything else has been manufactured, and if you want to manufacture a problem and pretend that it's some sort of thing that you have to completely restructure our economy and our society, no, thank you. You're on your own. And so the Democratic side is, well, you're weaponizing the debt ceiling. It's un-American. We didn't even default on debts in the Civil War. And what McConnell said is, we're not going to default now because you've got 50 votes and you've got the vice president and you're going to figure this thing out and you're going to get this thing through and we're not going to help you. If you're going to use the same 50-vote reconciliation package to try to jam all this through, then you can use the same package to figure out how to increase the debt ceiling. I think it's a very effective tool. I think the differences between the progressive and moderate wing of the Democratic Party are great enough that there's almost no wiggle room. I think at the end of the day, the power of Nancy Pelosi's office to kick you off a committee and throw money at you or for you forces these people to come around, even if they hate it. And I think somehow she gets to 218 votes on all three. But what I hope and what I do think is that $3.6 trillion gets carved way, way back. And every single social program is tied to economic behavior that makes sense. This country has never had economic behavior where you had a free lunch unless you're elderly or disabled or you're a child. This says no matter what you do, you don't have to do anything for the money and you never have to work and you never have to look for it. That's going to go away. I feel convinced of it. Those kinds of programs are not going to get through. An expanded tax credit for child care would be a good thing. Child care providers don't make any money. Working women have the hardest life I can imagine. But it's because they're working. If you're home, you are the kid's child care provider. And it makes no sense to disconnect. That's where the Republican Party is coming from. That's where Joe Manchin of West Virginia is coming from. And I think in the end of the day, they win. So there'll be something that'll pass beyond infrastructure, and there will be some increases. And there's going to be a bunch on climate, but it's not going to be anywhere near what the progressive won. Now, could they decide to go against the speaker and say, if you're going to do this to us, we're going to take our ball and go home? If they did that and they brought all this legislation down, there would be a huge price for them to pay. First of all, when you run in an election, you didn't get anything you said you got done. You didn't actually get it done. There's a big price for that. Your own guys lose heart. And they decide that, why would I vote for you? You just talk a big game, you don't deliver. And the AOCs of the world, I think, lose a lot of power in that scenario. Now, are they going to act like adults at 3 o'clock in the morning when they're stuck in this room? If anybody can make them act like adults, it's Speaker Pelosi. And if anybody can make the Republican discipline stay 100%, it's Mitch McConnell. So there's no weakness on either side that's going to be exploitable by either the press or someone inside their own caucus. The Republicans will stand firm. At the end of the day, I'm betting Pelosi gets something. And so with that, I'd like to open it to Q&A. Now, do I know what that something is? I don't. But it's way less than what you're looking at right now.
Just a quick question about
Yeah. So John brings up a very good point, the Supreme Court, how much of this is constitutional. I'm going to go back to FDR's first term, when he passed a whole bunch of things real quickly. The Supreme Court kept striking it down. You can't do this, it's not constitutional. The Supreme Court recently decided Obamacare wasn't constitutional because you can't mandate a tax on somebody on a good and service that they don't want. And you've got some things like that in here. The courts are fascinating, right? I mean, you have to be a genius to understand all three branches of government and figure out what they're going to do day to day. You have to be a bigger genius to figure out how to get something through that system. So, yeah, there's constitutionality issues. You know, is it constitutional to give money and expect nothing back, and you're not elderly, you're not disabled, and you're not a child? Because we're not asking these children to go to work. We're not asking an elderly person to go to work. We're not asking a disabled person to go to work. We're asking for a healthy, able-bodied person who's getting a tax credit and an expansion to go to work. I think that things like that will be struck down if they're not done right. So, but we're honestly at a point where there's so much up in the air that I almost don't know how to describe it. Because between those three votes on debt ceiling, infrastructure, and then this massive package, and there's chunks of the new Green Deal that people don't really understand. You've got some environmental equity, critical race theory stuff. You've got polluter fees and people of color being disadvantaged. You've just got a ton of stuff in the system. Honestly, think even the people voting on this stuff don't know what's in it. One of Speaker Pelosi's greatest quotes is, "We have to vote on Obamacare so we'll know what's in it." She had literally said that. And she was proud of it. She just wanted to get it through. What's that? The quote is, "We have to vote for Obamacare so we'll know what's in it." She didn't know what was in it. She also didn't know how people qualified. She also didn't know how people would be able to apply for these benefits inside the government, the .gov sign-up. And what she did is created a system that crashed the entire computer system and took 18 months to rewrite so that people could figure out how to make an application for a benefit for health care, because that's how screwed up the voting was. But if you ask her, and she cost 53 Democrats their seat in the next midterm, and her quote on that is, "Well, they weren't really good Democrats anyway. I would just as soon not have them." So that's the kind of people we deal with, and Republicans are equally hard-headed. You know, Mitch McConnell would say, "To hell with you. You're going to solve this all yourself, and I'm not doing anything to help you. I'm just going to sit here and watch Rome burn. Good luck with that." And that's how he's going to play it. So we got a lot of intrigue. We've got a lot of what I call second-rate theater. And we're going to have a bunch of real, what some would call come-to-Jesus moments at 2 or 3 in the morning as the clock winds towards government shutdown. But in my opinion, until things change in the political process, it is the only way you'll get a vote on anything. That's not controversial. No one will actually vote on something controversial, go out and talk about it, and wait a long time for it to pass without getting beat up by the right or the left. So this is probably, you know, Pelosi's told her entire caucus, "Bring your pajamas." They'll put cots out for the senators. They'll stay around the clock. They'll probably shut the government down a couple different times. They'll probably go through all kinds of stupid things between now and the end of the year. And that's really where we are. And I think I've laid out that I think some part of this goes, some part of this doesn't. And some part of this can test the Constitution. If anything, the Republicans have the strongest Supreme Court they've had since there's been a Supreme Court. And that's no exaggeration. Yes, sir.
Will the H.R. 1 pass?
Somebody repeat that for me.
Will H.R. 1 pass?
No. So let's get back to the voting rights thing. I don't see that passing, and I see that as the most dangerous thing of all, simply because you can never prove anything once it's all mail-in and you have no proof of identity. You know, early voting solves a lot of problems. In Virginia, we have an off-year governor's race, meaning it's not an even-numbered year. We're one of three states that does that. You could start voting on Labor Day all the way till November 4th, but you have to show up. You have to be there in person. And if you vote early, you have to say why, and you have to show your ID, and you have to show your voting card. And I think the states will continue to retain their rights. And I also believe, to John's question, because of the way our Constitution is written, I think it's unconstitutional to say that somebody in Washington, D.C. can control votes in all 50 states and take this out of the electors and the Electoral College and to take this away from the governors and the state's attorney general. I don't think it's constitutional. But I'd hate for it to get even to that point because this is a bad idea. And what it really does, and I think that the people in this room are great examples, it takes all the power away from people who make things and grow things and do things. And it gives all the power to people in cities that have no idea how their food is grown, how their fibers made, anything. And they really don't care. And this country's great strength, I think, is federalism. An electoral college, independent states, the ability for the Supreme Court to decide if a law is constitutional or not, checks and balances. And what the progressive wing wants is to make all that go away. And they want it to all go away now. And so you have 50 votes in the Senate, you don't, no filibuster, you can count votes up to 10 days after an election. Anything proves you're a voter, you can stick in a receipt, mail it in, and they have to count it, and the governors and the states have no say in how this comes out. Fundamentally undoes this country, and it fundamentally puts a lot of power into about 10 cities. And I'll go back to saying what I said the other day. There are 37 counties in this, or there's four counties in this country, five, that have more population than 37 states. And that's a big deal. Yes, ma'am. Can I get you? Can we repeat that for me? Okay, I got that. The progressives are saying all or nothing, and. You know, when you read their rhetoric and when you hear them interviewed, they say that. So if they do that, and they could, right? One thing you can't predict is human nature. That's a much harder thing to do than even election outcomes. Will they throw a temper tantrum and say, you need me more than I need you. I want this whole thing to crash and burn. And I'm going to go home and run for re-election and say, you didn't want to do the big things that this country demands. So Bernie Sanders issued a statement. This $3.6 trillion, we actually wanted $6 trillion. And we even wanted more than that. We've way skinnied this down to the bare minimum for the American people. Billionaire class doesn't pay. The businesses don't pay. The poor don't get anything. And I think if we don't get this, we should insist that we don't go back to Congress until we vote on these big things and win. So, Katie, could they do that? They could. But I more believe that at 3 o'clock in the morning when the speaker's looking you in the eye and saying, Do you want me to put a $5 million opponent against you, or do you want me to help you? And I'm going to tell you right now, you cannot get this through. You have to get it through the Senate. It has to come back through conference. It has to get 218 votes. It has to get 50 votes plus the vice president. There's a lot of things you might want. You don't have the votes. And one of the great mantras in D.C., and it's always been and it will always be, you don't have anything if you don't have the votes. And so I think the moderates will prevail. And I think you're going to read a lot of hateful things and anger and stomping out of meetings and corporate Democrats who've sold out. I've read some really interesting stuff where AOC attacks the Democrats like they were some version of a Hitler businessman. And I'm sure it gets their base all fired up, right? But at the end of the day, they don't have the votes. If Joe Biden had 60 Senate Democrats, the way Barack Obama did, and Nancy Pelosi had 242 Democrats in the House, the first 2 years of Obama, they could have done anything they wanted, anything. And nothing in the Republican Party could have even slowed it down. In this election, the Democrats lost 14 seats in the House and won the presidency. Now, the Republicans lost 2 seats in Georgia through a massive mess up that Trump created himself, in my opinion. But the fact is, the Democrats have control of all three branches, barely. Barely. And that's a big deal. And so when the progressives say, get rid of filibuster, get rid of electoral college, let anybody mail in, they want to build that majority up to real big because they don't like the system that produces the outcomes it produces and sends the people to Washington that it sends. It sends people like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who they hate, Kristen Sinema of Arizona, and they can't stand her either. And it creates people like that who have states that are going to pretty much support you if you support them. And it's been such a strength. Most senators who come here come from either state government, whether it's they were a delegate or a Senate or a House member or former governor, they know their states. And this would take all that out. And it even let people, you could put a progressive in all 50 states, move them there and get them residents after 6 months, and they'd have a better shot than maybe an incumbent. H.R. 1's a big deal. But everybody, I think, on the R side and the moderate D side know that. Other stuff, guys. I'm sure you're mad at me or you want to ask something else that makes sense. And certainly I want you to keep your eye on what Bob and I put out on these carbon sequestration dollars. It'll be a lot of good money. Bob?
Waters.
So waters of the U.S. This is one of my favorite subjects because God created water law so David Crow would never go unemployed. And I want to thank him right now. Thank you, God. Because there's nothing more screwed up, more convoluted, and more changeable, with the possible exception of immigration. So the waters of the U.S. rule, and I'm going to take you back. So in 1972, Congress passed the Federal Clean Water Pollution Act, and it was a big deal. It was a landmark decision. For those of us old enough to remember, Tom, the Cuyahoga River was on fire for 3 days. You really had some water issues that were atrocious, and you had bad water everywhere. And the Clean Water Act fixed that. But the Clean Water Act is designed to go after point sources of pollution. If you manufacture, like if you are a steel mill, if you are an automobile manufacturer, if you make anything, any pollution coming out of there has to be at a very high level. And so you stopped a lot of pollution right off the gate. But non-point source water is where I have job security because there is so many different jurisdictions covering water that I think it's 3,400 in the United States. Different entities have some control over water. And so what you really have, and for even smart people like you, is just trying to figure out who the hell's in charge, right? Is it Dublin? Is it Marysville? Is it the county? State of California laws are way beyond the federal government. We all know that. But it's a mess. So when Obama and Biden came into office, what they did was they decided that they would create a national blueprint for the federal government to basically regulate over 94% of all water. And how they were going to do this is to say all water is connected. So there have been three Supreme Court decisions. Justice Scalia said all water is not connected. It's not connected unless it's connected. He's more eloquent than that. He was a genius. But if there's no surface connection, then you can't regulate it as interstate water because it ain't connected. Right? You didn't even have to go to law school to know that. So Justice Kennedy, with his eloquence, said, no. If there's any significant nexus between water bodies, they're connected. Now, Tom and I use significant nexus all the time, but a lot of people don't know what the hell it means. How are you doing? Well, I've got a significant nexus that I'm going to show up for work next week. So the vagueness of it alone gave environmentalists unlimited room to say, wait a minute, if there's a floodplain, if there's a prior wetland that's been in any way dredged, all of this creates a pollution that can connect all water bodies. So what the Obama administration under Gina McCarthy at EPA, who's now the head of White House Climate, she said, we're going to define all water. And in that definition, 94% of all water bodies are going to be connected. And what that means very simply is if you do anything to these water bodies, you have to get a permit. You have to go to the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA and get a permit. And if in that permit, they'll tell you exactly what you can and can't do. And so farmers and a lot of others hated it. Trump actually campaigned and used the word WOTUS over and over. He actually used it in 16 in two different debates. And like, I'm flabbergasted. Who in the world running for president would talk about that? But enough farmers got to him, particularly, that he did. So the Obama Biden administration under McCarthy created all these definitions. They defined what a significant nexus is. They defined a prior converted wetland. They defined all streams and rivers. They defined ephemeral water, which is one of my favorites. An ephemeral water body might be a puddle near your driveway when you go to work and it dried up when you came home. For instance, in Arizona and New Mexico, the judge just ruled this last month, there are 1,451 streams that were surveyed that are ephemeral. Well, if you go to my home part of the world where it rains 8 to 10 inches a year, unless every once in a while it floods, you've got ephemeral water everywhere. So the federal district judge said all ephemeral water is connected. And that's what Waters of the U.S. wanted to do. So virtually the entire water bodies of the country are under federal control. So Trump undid that. He had his definitions. He shrunk these definitions, and he went back to if the water bodies aren't connected, they're not interstate waters. They got to be connected. There's got to be a surface connection, and it's got to make sense. And here are the definitions. That got through in June of 20. So then Biden wins, and Gina McCarthy hated what Trump did, and she immediately got Biden to introduce an executive order that said the new rule, known as Navigable Water Protection Act, creates irreparable harm in all 50 states. And she cited 333 projects that weren't jurisdictional by either EPA and Army Corps. So that's Washington ease for you don't need a permit. Now, the lawyers I work with analyzed it and said none of them should need a permit. They're not polluting waters of the U.S. But part of the climate change argument and part of the which party that you actually believe in argument is the federal government should control all water. And they should define all water. And they should have the right to issue a permit or tell you you can't do it. So the water issue's gone 180, and now it's 180 back. Now, could another president, say a Republican, 2024, undo this all over again? That's possible. But what I see is there's been two district court rulings that basically have vacated the Trump-era rule. And they've said all this ephemeral water is connected. It all pollutes downstream. And every bit of it needs to be regulated by the federal government. In my opinion, where we're headed, where a lot of you are going to be dealing for the rest of your careers, is anything you do of a sizable nature, you're going to need a permit. And that means you're going to have to do an environmental impact statement on most things. So the best single thing I ever heard that defined this issue for me happened at the end of the Obama-Biden administration. So Gina McCarthy was testifying, and a female manager, city manager of Boulder, Colorado, testified. Boulder's not a conservative place, and she was not a conservative person. So I'm thinking, what's she going to say? Because she's on the opposition to Waters of the U.S. panel. And so she said, I'm the city manager, and we've got a small park in Boulder, and it's got swing sets and almost kind of play things on one side, the stream in the middle, and we want to put a little bridge over so the kids can get to the other side. Under Waters of the U.S., my engineers tell me we would have to spend $340,000 to do an environmental impact statement on what that bridge is doing to that water. And that's bigger than my budget for the park. And I said, I will never forget this. So Gina McCarthy said, we'll work that out. Well, you can't because it's in writing. There's nothing to work out. It is. Well, the permit people would never make you do that. No, my engineers just costed this out. This is real stuff in real time. I'm bringing you fresh numbers. And we're not making this up. Well, no. So then Heidi Heitkamp, then a Democratic senator from North Dakota and really a great member. I miss her a lot because she's really one of those straight talkers. She puts up a map of North Dakota. She says, Ms. McCarthy, does this look like a wet place to you? And it's like looking at Arizona for me. It's like, oh, my God, no. This is the driest place on earth. Said, under your rule, because of the floodplain rule, 97% of my state can be a wetland. Oh, no, Senator, that's not right. She said, don't you tell me I'm not right. I'm a United States senator. I had that map made. I surveyed every bit of the water bodies. I'm looking at your definition, and you've just declared my state a wetland. Oh, no. We'll work that out. And that's the way this whole thing went. I'm like, but because Trump won and he immediately put an executive order, he stopped all that. Now, Biden has stopped Trump's rule before it started. Really a great metaphor for what's going on in today. Just confusing as hell. Well, where we're headed, folks, is a national water system, EPA, Army Corps. If you ask my opinion, put a gun to my head, what are you guys going to be dealing with the rest of your careers? You're going to be dealing with that. And it means it doesn't matter what your state thinks. It doesn't matter what your head of EPA or your head of ag thinks, because they don't regulate this anymore. The Army Corps of Engineers does in consultation with EPA.
Training people, like how
a great question. So these new set of sequestration rules and this carbon capture, this almost happened in Obama's first term, and the exact same questions came up. And I think it's the question for the age in the sense that no matter what you think of climate change, and probably only abortion and a handful of things are worse to talk about, right? I mean, just people go kind of crazy on this. There's not a widespread agreement on how to capture carbon, how to measure carbon. This is my opinion. Nevertheless, the short answer to your question, which I think we have to do, is Tom Vilsack, Secretary of Ag, is going to tell you. He's going to set out some guidelines, and he's going to say, if you're a tree or any kind of fiber or grass or growing anything, and you do these following procedures, and he's going to lay it out, I'm going to pay you for that. What they're hoping to do, and they're going to have to be a lot of training, and it's going to be run by the USDA field offices, right? And there's going to be guidance at the national level. The National Resource Conservation Service, NRCS, will run most of this. But it'll all be done in the state field offices. They're going to lay this out. So one of my clients is also part of my family, Illinois corn growers. Every conversation is about this. Well, how can you prove it? How can you prove any of this? My answer is what it'll be to you, what Tom Vilsack says. I think this is an area that's going to go on a long time before we get it right. The legislation I was referring to early in the Obama era, Obama had a big issue that he had all the votes in the world, but he had about five things he needed to get done. He couldn't get them all done. He picked health care. In second place would have been environment, and it would have been cap and trade. And Kim, to answer your question, is the way you asked it, is if you could sell carbon credits to your manufacturing neighbor, let's say you have a steel mill next to you, and they just can't reduce emissions very much, but you've somehow used solar and electric and you've done all kinds of things, I can sell you credits and you can still produce your steel. So a national cap and trade system was basically a stock market for carbon pollution. Now, in the end, I think that's where we're going to end up, for the simple reason that most people in business have to know, what does it cost me? Like, if I ask you, do you want to rebuild the plant, and you go, wow, it cost me $50 million. Well, you need $10 million worth of carbon credits. Your neighbor has $10 million to sell because he reduced something that you can't. So in the big world, pollution was reduced, and you did a good thing, and you both can go about your business. At this particular moment in time, it's just going to be based on practices that Tom Vilsack and the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture lays out that EPA will review, and it will tell you that if you do ABC, I'm going to give you money for it. So this, we're at the beginning again of something, and this time climate change is in a way different place than it was when Obama was first elected. And when I say that, it's because companies like Scott's and lots of companies have embraced this and have started doing things that they weren't told to do. They're doing sustainability things. They're doing a lot of things that no one did 20 years ago, 12 years ago. And there is not just on electric vehicles, but on every bit of manufacturing, packaging, supply chain. You've got a tremendous amount of energy, and it's become a marketing issue, right, for all of us. It's a good thing to do, like recycling. Who's against that? So this is going to be uneven. It's going to start slow. But I think you've got enough momentum in both parties, and particularly in the generation that's come of age now, that this never dies, and it gets bigger. Electric vehicles is the first thing. Clean power grids, more solar, more wind. But the carbon capture actually on the land is the thing that requires more definition, more training, more rules, and they're coming. I hope that's a good answer. I really believe that's right.
Are there any additional questions?
Thank you.
Is this your phone, David? I'll give it to him later. Okay, I know you're all anxious. Just a few things to wrap up here. So hopefully you enjoyed the sessions over the last 2 days. I do have an exciting announcement. So you might have heard yesterday Bob mention, I think we were 2 under the record for the largest MSC annual meeting. And I am happy to announce that this has become the largest Mulch and Soil Council meeting ever with 176 people. So that, and we should have a round of applause for sure. With that, I do want to make sure I'm thanking the members, all of you for coming, being engaged, networking, interacting. You are what make this meaningful, beneficial, and allow us to kind of continue this industry meeting and really ensure we're delivering for the future. I would also like to make sure to thank our sponsors and our speakers over the last few days. Hopefully you learned a lot from them. Again, that content will be available hopefully next week on the Mulch and Soil Council website. And then I know some of you have approached me with feedback. Please know we enjoy to hear how did we do, did we hit on topics you're interested in, even giving ideas for next year's topics as well. So if you have feedback, positive improvements, please reach out to myself, Bob, any of the board members. We will make sure to incorporate that into future meetings as well. With that, I hope everyone has safe travels wherever you're going, whether it's this evening, tomorrow, however you're getting home, back to your families, and wherever you're heading afterwards. However, before you do that, please make sure you enjoy the President's Reception, which is again provided by Social Marks Media, and that is right around the corner, pretty much starting right now until 6 o'clock. Thank you all again. I appreciate it.